to the integrity of the United Kingdom. Raab later voted for Boris Johnson's supposedly oven-ready deal that kept Northern Ireland attached to EU regulations, but not before revealing in January 2019 that he hadn't actually read the Good Friday Agreement. The treaty brought fragile peace to Northern Ireland by implying that there would be no return to a hard border on the island of Ireland. Had he bothered to read it, he should have realised that the security installations required to operate a post-Brexit hard border would run foul of a key pledge in the GFA to demilitarise. The 1998 GFA, also known as the Belfast Agreement, represented one of the most significant and substantive challenges to any form of Brexit and runs to just 35 pages in length. Yet Raab explained, "It's not like a novel where you sit down and say, do you know what, over the holidays, this is a cracking read." History does not relate what he was reading, but he was indeed on holiday when Kabul fell to the Taliban on the 15th of August 2021. By now promoted to Foreign Secretary by Boris Johnson, whose government had already threatened to break international law by attempting to override its own Brexit withdrawal agreement, many expected him to return to his desk. He did not. He remained on holiday in Crete with his family as the Afghan government collapsed, and instead delegated crucial tasks to other ministers. Appearing before the Foreign Affairs Select Committee the following month, he refused 9 times to reveal when his holiday had begun, and later rejected reports that he had been paddleboarding as the Taliban seized control, saying, "The stuff about me paddleboarding is just nonsense. The sea was actually closed. It was a red notice." Before August was out, the Independent quoted Greek meteorologist Theodoros Kolidas as saying, "We did not have any significant weather phenomenon in the area of Crete between 12th and 15th of August. The winds were north with a maximum of 6 to 7 Beaufort, and the weather was locally cloudy." Alexandros Roniotis, whose Cretan Beaches website lists information about the island's coastline, added, "No beaches were closed, only some gorges during the big fires, but no beaches." Raab was out of the Foreign Office the following month and out of favour completely for the duration of Liz Truss's brief but disastrous premiership. But when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister on the 25th of October 2022, he immediately restored Raab to the position of Deputy Prime Minister. He did so despite Raab facing multiple allegations of bullying from colleagues. After 8 formal complaints and at Raab's request, Sunak set up an independent inquiry by a senior lawyer, Adam Tolley KC. Raab pledged to resign his position if the inquiry found him to have engaged in bullying behaviour. The report delivered to Sunak and Raab on the 20th of April 2023 found Raab guilty of intimidating and aggressive behaviour that fitted a description of bullying. It is fair to say that Raab, who described the inquiry he had called for as flawed, did not depart gracefully. His resignation letter was an exercise in narcissistic self-indulgence. "I am genuinely sorry for any unintended stress or offence that any officials felt as a result of the pace, standards and challenge that I brought to the Ministry of Justice. That is, however, what the public expect of ministers working on their behalf. In setting the threshold for bullying so low, this inquiry has set a dangerous precedent. It will encourage spurious complaints against ministers and have a chilling effect on those driving change on behalf of your government and ultimately the British people." He continued in this spectacularly self-pitying vein in an article published by The Telegraph before Tolley's report had even been released. It appeared under the frankly remarkable headline, "The People of Britain Will Pay for This Kafkaesque Saga." The usual suspects were soon gathered in agreement. The Daily Mail's front page asked, "Was this the day Britain became ungovernable?" For their star columnist, Richard Littlejohn, it was Raab's critics who were entitled and self-pitying. He went on to share his dewy-eyed nostalgia for the days when it was commonplace for a male newspaper editor to tell a female subordinate to fuck off, and tellingly blamed the absence of an unspecified, fully functioning Brexit on a left-leaning broadcast blob, a self-important legal establishment, and an unelected House of Lords. The same House of Lords, of course, into which the Daily Mail's editor-in-chief, Paul Dacre, seems so desperate to be elevated. What else explains why the paper continued to cheerlead for his sponsor, Boris Johnson, long after he had been chased out of Downing Street by his own cabinet after being found to have lied again, this time about the appointment of a notorious sex pest to a senior government role? Incredibly, Raab's own elevation to deputy PM had been only the second most depressing appointment to Sunak's first cabinet. For approximately 5 hours on that October day, the more optimistic observers of British politics hoped we had finally reached rock bottom and the country was turning over a new leaf. On the steps of 10 Downing Street, Sunak spoke of his determination to restore integrity, professionalism, and accountability to his government. Many thought that this heralded a deliberate departure from the legacy of Boris Johnson, under whom the obvious incompetence, ignorance, and, crucially, impunity of a character like Raab had been free to flourish. By 5 p.m, however, it had become clear that Sunak either could not or would not wean his administration off the crackpipe of moral corruption that Johnson and his ludicrous coterie of cronies and sycophants had been puffing away on for the best part of 3 years. And it was not the reappointment of Raab that signalled this most clearly. It was the reappointment of Suella Braverman to the position of Home Secretary just 6 days after she had been effectively fired by Truss for a blatant breach of the ministerial code. In the spirit of those Russian dolls, and as further proof of the way that recalling one scandalous episode immediately prompts memories of others, the mere mention of the ministerial code within spitting distance of the phrase legacy of Boris Johnson conjures up the memory of Braverman's predecessor in the Home Office, Priti Patel. In November 2020, after an 8-month inquiry, Johnson's independent advisor on ministerial standards, Sir Alex Allen, found that Patel had bullied Home Office staff. Johnson not only ignored his findings, but also texted Tory MPs with an instruction to form a square around the Pritster. Allen promptly resigned in protest, and less than 2 years later, so too did Christopher Lord Gait, Johnson's second ethics advisor, who had been so bruised by Wallpapergate. More on this later, but it is important to note this was the backdrop against which Sunak promised integrity, accountability, and professionalism, before putting ministerial codebreaker Braverman back into the Home Office and reinstating soon-to-be-proven bully Raab as Deputy Prime Minister. Once there, Braverman wasted little time in laying claim to being one of the most deliberately divisive and willfully unpleasant politicians of the modern era, and that is a crowded field. In January 2023, an 83-year-old Holocaust survivor called Joan Salter rose to her feet at a constituency meeting in Fareham, Hampshire, and asked her MP, the newly reinstalled Home Secretary, to moderate the language she routinely uses to describe refugees and asylum seekers. Salter, who received an MBE for her work on Holocaust education, compared Braverman's rhetoric on migrants crossing the English Channel in so-called small boats to language used by the Nazis during the Second World War. She said, "In 1943, I was forced to flee my birthplace in Belgium and went across war-torn Europe and dangerous seas until I finally was able to come to the UK in 1947. When I hear you using words against refugees like swarms and invasion, I am reminded of the language used to dehumanise and justify the murder of my family and millions of others. Why do you find the need to use that kind of language?" Braverman responded, "There is a huge problem that we have right now when it comes to illegal migration, the scale of which we have not known before. I won't apologise for the language that I have used to demonstrate the scale of the problem. I see my job as being honest with the British people and honest for the British people. I'm not going to shy away from difficult truths, nor am I going to conceal what is the reality that we are all watching." Braverman, who does not merit a chapter of her own in this book, has not personally used the word swarm in this context. But former Prime Minister David Cameron and former UKIP leader Nigel Farage, who do, have both done so. This episode, and the broader context in which it unfolded, is illustrative for 3 key reasons. It depicts the shameless commoditisation of hate in public life, the traducing of basic accuracy, and the culture of impunity in which politicians like Braverman, Raab, and almost everyone else in this book have been able to flourish. For while Braverman, like Raab, is more symptom than cause of the corrupted ecosystem, she has repeatedly shown herself willing to go further and faster down the dirtiest of political sewers than any of her colleagues. And besides, successful diagnoses generally begin with an examination of symptoms. By any reasonable measure, she should not have been in the job at all. Less than 3 months previously, on the 19th of October 2022, Braverman had been compelled to resign as Home Secretary after 43 days in the job when it emerged that she had used a personal email account to forward a government document to a political ally. At least, that was the reason she gave at the time, stating, "Earlier today, I sent an official document from my personal email to a trusted parliamentary colleague as part of policy engagement and with the aim of garnering support for government policy on migration. This constitutes a technical infringement of the rules." She continued, "As soon as I realised my mistake, I rapidly reported this on official channels and informed the Cabinet Secretary." In fact, she had not only sent the document to a political ally, Sir John Hayes, but had also tried to copy in his wife, who works in his office. It later emerged that she had accidentally sent the draft written statement on immigration, with potential implications for market-sensitive growth forecasts from the OBR, to a staff member of another Conservative MP, Andrew Percy. The BBC later established that it was Percy who first reported this clear breach of the ministerial code to the Chief Whip, who is responsible for party discipline. The Chief Whip passed the information on to Number 10 and the Cabinet Office. The BBC further reported that, according to sources, Cabinet Secretary Simon Case had not, at this point, been approached by Braverman herself. As with Raab, her resignation letter was petulant and self-serving. She wrote, "It is obvious to everyone that we are going through a tumultuous time. I have concerns about the direction of this government. Not only have we broken key pledges that were promised to our voters, but I have had serious concerns about this government's commitment to honouring manifesto commitments, such as reducing overall migration numbers and stopping illegal migration, particularly the dangerous small boats crossings." Seeking asylum is not illegal. Neither, according to international law, is travelling to a country by irregular means to do so. But as with almost all of the politicians who have flourished since Brexit, it is hard to know whether Braverman is being deliberately disingenuous or simply lacks the intelligence to understand the inaccuracy of what she states with such confidence. It may be unfair to wonder whether she is lying or stupid, or possibly both, but there is evidence for each of these accusations. In March 2017, she was deputy chair of the ERG and appeared on BBC Question Time. Asked about the financial cost of the UK leaving the EU, she stated, "This figure of £50 billion doesn't have any legal basis whatsoever. It's been manufactured, and it doesn't seem likely that there will be such a bill for £50 million. It's part of Project Fear. Health warning, don't believe it. And you know, we pay into the European Investment Bank, and so actually we're going to get a windfall from leaving. So I think that the scaremongering about having to pay to leave is just not true. We have a lot to gain. Our best days lie ahead, and we're going to be enjoying the freedoms and enjoying the benefits that we gain from leaving." As of July 2022, the Treasury's estimate of the actual divorce bill, best understood as the UK's share of obligations agreed to while an EU member, was £35.6 billion. The OBR foresees payments continuing until 2064. Whether Braverman understood this and lied, or failed to understand it but nevertheless persisted in her Brexit beliefs, is impossible to say. Similarly, we cannot be sure precisely what she understood the word contributor to mean when she claimed on the website of her barrister's chambers to have fulfilled that role with regard to the 2007 textbook, Gambling for Local Authorities, Licensing, Planning and Regeneration. The book's author, Philip Colvin KC, told the Big Issue magazine in October 2022 that Braverman did not make a written or editorial contribution to the book. However, on one occasion, I asked her to do some photocopying for the book, which she did. These vignettes are important because, as with Raab, Braverman's career highlights not only how utterly inadequate individuals can rise to the highest offices in the land, but also how obvious, outrageous failures to observe even the lowest standards of basic probity and accuracy go completely unpunished. Even as I write, some 7 years after the referendum, impeccable Brexit credentials, or at least a refusal to acknowledge its disastrous consequences, remain the only requirements for political promotion. People who would once have been non-entities, or at the very most eccentric adornments to a more serious political landscape, have been able to flourish. For example, Braverman succeeded Brexit hardman Steve Baker as chair of the ERG and was herself succeeded by Jacob Rees-Mogg, All three would become ministers after their tenure at the head of the deeply bizarre parliamentary group, who later started referring to themselves as Spartans, because, and only because, they would not attract unhinged newspaper coverage. Or the rent-a-quote ire of Nigel Farage, the former UKIP and Brexit Party leader, who had stalked the Conservative Party for over a decade by promising that, however xenophobic and dishonest they became, he would always be prepared to go further. Crucially, most of the cast from this tragedy of errors is still on the stage. It is hard to see how anything can improve until they quit it. I have a very weird day job. Every weekday, I present a phone-in show on national radio in a slot that has, in the years I've been doing it, become the most popular speech-based programme in the United Kingdom among the commercial stations where presenters are permitted to espouse their views. I mention this not only to boast. Its success proves that popularity is not dependent upon complicity in the corruption of our country. But if I sometimes wonder whether things can really be as bad as I believe them to be, then goodness knows how easy it must be to suffer similar doubts if you don't pay attention to and talk about politics for a living. There are moments on air when, midway through a tirade against the latest example of epic wrongdoing, I catch myself wondering whether I've accidentally libelled someone, whether the facts can really be as outrageous as I am relating, or whether I've somehow misremembered. It's as if saying it out loud, or, I'm often told, hearing it said out loud, delivers an urgency that can be lacking from the printed word. I think humans sometimes need the emotional heft of tone, the squeakiness of incredulity, to see the full picture. I can't provide that here. This book is an attempt to collect as much proof as I can, more for my own peace of mind rather than for posterity, and to offer an explanation of how it happened. Obviously, there was no real plan or secret conspiracy to break Britain, and many of the culprits no doubt genuinely believed that their actions would somehow benefit the country. Some of them still do. It has happened because of a unique congregation of coincidences and circumstances that allowed a phalanx of arrogant, petulant, and preternaturally self-important individuals to wreak untold havoc. The ones with their names atop each chapter of this book are best viewed as portals through which we must pass in search of greater understanding of how they broke Britain. Most of them are household names. Some of them are not. Most of them sit within the diabolical nexus of media, politics, and think tank. Some of them do not. Most of them have exercised power. Some of them have not. But all of them have made monumental contributions to the immense and entirely avoidable denigration of our nation. First, and most foundational, I focus on print media grown fat on the commoditization of hatred and othering, but now in existential decline and desperate for relevance. Rupert Murdoch, Chapter 1, and Paul Dacre, Chapter 2, the editor-in-chief of the Mail titles, lead this field by an enormous margin. Murdoch because, as is perhaps best demonstrated by recent revelations regarding his Fox News Network's role in deliberately amplifying Donald Trump's lies about the 2022 presidential election, truth will always be subjugated to populism in pursuit of profit. His is a cynicism devoid of ideology, and it allows him to excuse any violation of basic decency on the grounds of pursuing money or influence. Dacre, by contrast, seems to be a true believer and is therefore in many ways more dangerous. Because when you believe passionately that your own superiority and worldview, which in his case involves an apparent nostalgia for traditional Victorian notions, that Britain is a country where a woman's place is in the home, Englishmen have every right to rule the world, and ethnic minorities know their place, are under attack from the forces of modernity and diversity, you will do anything to prevail. Less obviously, perhaps, I turn to Andrew Neil, Chapter 3, the former Murdoch editor who was chairman of the little red but disproportionately influential Spectator magazine, has presided over the once august organ of high church conservatism's descent into a sewer where Islamophobes, conspiracy theorists, racists and even Nazi apologists flourish. Neil also highlights the way in which the last bastion of truly impartial journalism in the UK, the BBC, has been cowed and almost captured by avowedly right-wing interests. Crucially, the media landscape created by Murdoch and Dacre monstered anyone at the corporation with even the slightest hint of leftist loyalties. Yet Neil was not only able to work there as a senior political presenter for years without objection, but also preside over his various protégés' cross-fertilisation of the Tory party and those secretly funded think tanks. In return, his most vitriolic, bigoted columnists can shroud themselves in bogus respectability and undertake lucrative work for Dacre and Murdoch. A current columnist and commissioning editor is even the wife of Dominic Cummings, Chapter 8, who himself enjoyed a largely unreported stint as online editor of the title. Through Cummings' partner at the helm of Vote Leave, Matthew Elliott, Chapter 4, we will come to understand how, and crucially why, British media became infested with people from hard-right, secretly funded lobby groups who are routinely treated with undeserved respect and who often move seamlessly into government roles. Into the hideous space created by this collective abnegation of the most basic journalistic standards stepped a generation of politicians equipped with whatever skills were necessary to thrive within it. David Cameron, Chapter 6, an apparently affable patrician who seemed to believe that Prime Minister was the only job of sufficient status to accommodate his myriad attributes and talents. More dangerously, he also seemed to think that having risen without trace through British society due chiefly to patronage and inherited advantage, he was just the chap to fend off the jingoistic furies of Euroscepticism that had beset his party for decades and seen off at least two of his predecessors as party leader. If Cameron's downfall was his arrogance, his nemesis was Nigel Farage, Chapter 5. An ingratiating and insidious relic of the 1970s far right, Farage managed to avoid the fate of previously prominent fascist-adjacent politicians by eschewing their sinister surliness, most of the time, and instead dressing up as a country squire while cloaking himself in a miasma of beer fumes and cigarette smoke. A generation left bamboozled and betrayed by the swiftness with which the Britain of Bernard Manning and Enoch Powell had been abandoned took him to their hearts because he made their prejudices feel respectable again. The red carpet of racism down which Farage merrily slithered had, of course, been rolled out by the likes of Murdoch, Dacre and Neil. And however hard they tried to pretend otherwise, Cummings and Elliott could not have triumphed in 2016 without him. 3 years later, the only politician who did even more to deliver that victory, Boris Johnson, Chapter 9, was in Downing Street after all of the factors and characters above combined with the pitiful Jeremy Corbyn, Chapter 7, to offer the UK public an electoral choice between the wholly unconscionable and the utterly unelectable. The costs of that cocktail of political crapulence are still being counted today. But, perhaps most remarkably of all, the stage was set for the eventual elevation of a politician who will be seen in years to come as the embodiment of everything that broke Britain, Liz Truss, Chapter 10. I could continue writing this introduction forever. Every rock I look under reveals 10 more rocks. Every day something new happens to deepen the awfulness and the absurdity of what these 10 people, their allies and their cohorts have done to our country and to all of us. I was going to close by portentously inviting you to step into their infernal lair. But you are, of course, already in it. We all are. This is how it happened. Chapter 1. Rupert Murdoch. I work for a man who wants it all and doesn't understand anybody telling him he can't have it all. Former Rupert Murdoch employee, Paul V. Carlucci. On the 21st of November 2014, Andy Coulson was released from prison after serving barely a quarter of an 18-month sentence for conspiracy to intercept voicemails, or phone hacking, as it is colloquially known. Coulson's crimes were committed when he was editor of Rupert Murdoch's first UK newspaper acquisition, The News of the World. He resigned from that post in January 2007, shortly before the paper's royal editor, Clive Goodman, became the first of several Murdoch journalists to be jailed for phone hacking. Just 6 months after that, in July, Coulson became the Conservative Party's Director of Communications, and when David Cameron became Prime Minister in May 2010, Coulson became Director of Communications for the UK government. On the eve of Cameron's Tory conference speech in October 2009, Coulson's former lover, Rebecca Brooks, née Wade, acquitted co-defendant in the phone hacking trial, boss at Murdoch's News International, and recently married to an old Etonian friend of Cameron's, texted the Tory leader, "I am so rooting for you tomorrow, and not just as a personal friend, but because professionally, we're definitely in this together. Coulson resigned from Cameron's government in January 2011 as the phone hacking scandal gathered pace. It did so almost entirely due to the tireless journalism of The Guardian's Nick Davis and the advocacy of the Labour MPs Tom Watson and Chris Bryant. Unlike the New York Times, most of the UK media and the entire Conservative government remained ambivalent, cowed, or downright hostile toward the story until Davis reported that the News of the World had illegally targeted the missing schoolgirl Millie Dowler and her family, allegedly interfering with police inquiries into her disappearance. 3 days later, the Murdoch family announced the closure of the newspaper after 168 years in print. The day after that, Coulson was arrested. At his trial in 2014, Mr. Justice Saunders told the court that the News of the World's initial failure to tell police that their journalists had hacked the voicemail of Millie Dowler, later found to have been murdered, came from a desire to take credit for finding her and sell newspapers. When he described that delay as unforgivable, he was being somewhat optimistic. In March 2017, the public relations firm that Coulson set up after leaving prison, Coulson Chapel, was awarded a contract to enhance the reputations of the Daily Telegraph and Sunday Telegraph. The Guardian's media columnist Roy Greenslade wrote at the time, "His main brief is thought to be to promote the papers as truthful and authoritative." Despite Coulson's disgrace, Conservative prime ministers continued to hire hacks straight from the stable of increasingly right-wing and later Brexit-addled newspapers. On the 10th of February 2017, the political editor of the Daily Mail, James Slack, became Prime Minister Theresa May's official spokesman, a position he retained after Boris Johnson became Prime Minister in July 2019. 18 months later, he became Director of Communications after the resignation of Dominic Cummings' ally and Vote Leave's former head of broadcast, Lee Kane. Slack, who had written the Daily Mail's ridiculous Steal of the New Iron Lady front page, claiming that Theresa May was ready to walk away from Brexit negotiations with no deal and make EU pay, left Downing Street in April 2021 to become Deputy Editor of Rupert Murdoch's Sun. He was replaced by Jack Doyle, a former associate editor politics at the Daily Mail. It later emerged that Slack had thrown a leaving party at Downing Street on the eve of the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral that descended into a drunken debauch with reports of a suitcase full of alcohol being wheeled onto the premises. At the time, gatherings of two or more people indoors and six or more people outdoors were prohibited under lockdown rules forged in the very building where Slack and around 45 colleagues celebrated. Records show that the last two members of staff left at 3:11 a.m. and 4:20 a.m. shortly before cleaners arrived to start dealing with the wine spillages and pools of vomit. It all struck a stark contrast with a now famous image of the late Queen sitting alone in St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle the same day, as attendees at her husband's funeral studiously observed lockdown regulations, with guests from separate households sitting 2 metres apart. The full details of Slack's party were published in Sue Gray's report on lockdown breaking in Downing Street in September 2022. Even though details of the party, including damage to a children's swing and slide set in the Downing Street garden, filled 2 pages of Gray's report, the Sun's initial reporting omitted all mention of Deputy Editor Slack's involvement. It is not known whether Slack, Kane, or Doyle were among the 83 people fined by the Metropolitan Police over the various illegal gatherings, but Slack remains a commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, CBE, a gong given to him by Theresa May. There is a logic, perhaps even an inevitability, to politicians seeking media advice from media professionals. But the revolving door of cronyism, criminality, and cosiness catalogued above is altogether more dangerous. For while previous newspaper proprietors had occasionally been quite open about their intentions, the first newspaper baron, Lord Beaverbrook, told the Royal Commission on the Press in 1948 that he ran the Express purely for the purpose of making propaganda and with no other object. I look at it as a purely propagandist project. Their influence was almost always exerted from outside government. Even Bernard Ingham, Margaret Thatcher's highly effective chief press secretary, was a career civil servant. And while Alistair Campbell, who would fulfil the same role for Tony Blair, did come into politics direct from Fleet Street, not even his harshest critics would claim that he continued to serve the interests of his former employers. Today newspaper, where he was political editor prior to joining the then leader of the opposition's team in 1994, had been bought by Rupert Murdoch in 1987 and published its final issue in 1995. Coulson's appointment, by contrast, saw a Murdoch man installed at the very heart of government. A man, moreover, whose former boss and lover had stated that David Cameron's Conservative government and Rupert Murdoch's News International were embarked on a joint mission. This was a mission that, by at least one account, was already well underway when Cameron was still in opposition. The words of Gordon Brown, who Cameron replaced as Prime Minister after the 2010 general election, must of course be viewed through the lens of his loss, but a speech he gave to the House of Commons in July 2011 is nonetheless striking. Coining the phrase criminal media nexus to describe the relationships to be investigated by the Leveson inquiry into the culture, practices and ethics of the British press, Brown revealed, "I have compiled for my own benefit a note of all the big policy matters affecting the media that arose in my time as Prime Minister. That note also demonstrates in detail the strange coincidence of how News International and the then Conservative opposition came to share almost exactly the same media policy. It was so close that it was often expressed in almost exactly the same words, on the future of the licence fee, on BBC Online, on the right of the public to see free of charge the maximum possible number of national sporting events, on the future of the BBC's commercial arm, and on the integrity of Ofcom, we stood up for what we believed to be the public interest. But that was made difficult when the opposition invariably reclassified the public interest as the News International interest. It is for the Commission of Inquiry to examine not just the promises of the then opposition, but the many early decisions of this government on these matters." Brown, it should be said, was being at least a tad disingenuous in suggesting that keeping Murdoch's suite had been a uniquely Tory preoccupation. In the same week he delivered this speech, David Cameron was reported to have met with Murdoch executives on 26 separate occasions during his first 15 months in office, but Brown and his predecessor Blair had hardly kept their distance. Lance Price, who worked as advisor to Tony Blair between 1997 and 2001, has written that Murdoch seemed like the 24th member of the cabinet, adding, "his presence was always felt." And when the Sun told Brown that they knew his son Fraser had cystic fibrosis, he worked with the newspaper to ensure sensitive coverage. Nor did he mention in his speech reports that his wife Sarah had hosted a slumber party at Chequers for Rebecca Brooks, Rupert Murdoch's wife Wendy, and his daughter Elizabeth. But it is clear that seeking support from Murdoch's titles, or at least seeking to avoid attack, is different from actively promoting his commercial aims, especially with regard to the BBC, Ofcom, and the proliferation of pay-per-view sporting events. For a brief moment, it looked likely that the Leveson Judicial Public Inquiry might blow the lid off the relationships described by Brown in a speech he knew would not be widely reported, and Brooks in text messages she never expected to be made public. It is important to remember, though, that Cameron only called the Leveson Inquiry after revelations about the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone finally propelled public outrage at his News International cronies to a level he could no longer ignore. Indeed, that gushing, "rooting for you tomorrow" text Brooks had sent to Cameron on the eve of his 2009 conference speech only emerged through the inquiry gaining access to all manner of private communications at the heart of Murdoch's empire. It is worth examining it and Cameron's later explanation in full. But seriously, I do understand the issue with the Times. Let's discuss over country supper soon. On the party, it was because I had asked a number of NI, News International, people to Manchester post-endorsement, the Sun had recently declared its support for Cameron, and they were disappointed not to see you. But as always, Sam, Cameron's wife, was wonderful, and I thought it was OEs, old Etonians, that were charm personified. I am so rooting for you tomorrow, not just as a proud friend, but because professionally we're definitely in this together. Speech of your life? Yes, he can. Under cross-examination by Robert J. QC, the leading counsel in the Leveson inquiry, Cameron helpfully put this extraordinary message into context. The issue with the Times was that at the party conference, I had not been to the Times party. The major newspaper groups tend to have big parties at the party conference, and they expect party leaders, cabinet ministers, shadow cabinet ministers to go. And that would be the normal thing to do. The Telegraph, the Times, and others would do this. I hadn't gone, and I think that was what this was about. And I was apologising for that, and that explains her disappointment, as it were. The day after Cameron's conference speech, The Sun carried a large front-page picture of him and the headline, "Cam can have a go because we think he's hard enough." Inside the newspaper, a leader column headlined, "Yes, he can," echoed Brooks's text precisely. Rather more seriously, less than 6 months after that excruciating cross-examination when Leveson published his report, it quickly became clear that, for all his flowery regret and acknowledgement of the need for change, Cameron would not be enacting the legislation to fulfil any of Leveson's recommendations. Worse, perhaps, the second part of the inquiry, focused on the relationships between journalists and the police, was originally postponed until criminal prosecutions regarding events at the News of the World had concluded. In 2017, however, the Conservative election manifesto pledged to drop the inquiry entirely. 6 years after Rupert Murdoch had himself appeared before MPs investigating phone hacking and declared, "This is the most humble day of my life," and 5 after the investigation concluded he was not a fit person to exercise the stewardship of a major international company, the greatest ever threat to his stranglehold on UK politics and media had apparently been seen off. By the middle of 2023, a plethora of cases alleging all manner of misdeeds were pending against not only Murdoch titles, but also Paul Dacre's Daily Mail and the Daily Mirror, edited for some of the relevant period by Piers Morgan, a Murdoch protégé and former editor of the News of the World. It seemed possible that another, potentially even more damning chapter of the scandal was about to be written. A dizzying array of extremely high-profile individuals, including Prince Harry, Elton John, Hugh Grant, and Baroness Doreen Lawrence, seemed determined to have their day in court, but it is impossible to predict any outcomes with confidence, or without alerting libel lawyers. Let us turn instead to what constitutes the second biggest scandal, and quite possibly the second humblest day, of Murdoch's life. This is not the place to delve further into the findings and failings of the Leveson inquiry. At most, it represents a missed opportunity for enacting changes that may have prevented or diluted some of the damage detailed here. It is relevant now only insofar as it demonstrates the breathtaking extent of the collusion between political power and the media institutions that claim to hold political power to account. Historically, the democratic process has always depended upon the ability and determination of journalists to do things that governments do not want them to do, to reveal things that governments do not want revealed, and to provide populations with the knowledge they need to make informed electoral choices. Murdoch's malevolent genius lies in the early realization that the same engines of influence could persuade people to vote not in their own interests, but in pursuit of his. Unlike other proprietors of the last 100 years, Murdoch's presenters and columnists do not lie or incite hatred or flirt with fascistic ideas because their boss is drawn to fascism. They do so because it is good for business, his business. There is even an ideology of sorts at the heart of this overweening thirst. In 2009, at the Edinburgh International Television Festival, Rupert Murdoch's son James, News Corporation's chairman and chief executive in Europe and Asia, gave the prestigious McTaggart Lecture. Entitled "The Absence of Trust," he used it to launch blistering attacks on the BBC, the media industry regulator Ofcom, the European Union, and the Labour government. It makes an interesting companion piece to Gordon Brown's later claims of conservative policies and language coinciding completely with the stated aims of the Murdochs. He even articulated the future he would like to see. "There is an inescapable conclusion that we must reach if we are to have a better society. The only reliable, durable, and perpetual guarantor of independence is profit." 11 years later, he appeared to have had a change of heart about News Corporation's own decisions in its apparent pursuit of profit over truth, Murdoch Fease resigned from the family business in July 2020 due to disagreements over certain editorial content published by the company's news outlets and certain other strategic decisions. And while it has long been impossible to exaggerate the extent of his father's cancerous appetite for money and power, it had not previously been possible to prove it beyond all reasonable doubt. In April 2023, a defamation lawsuit brought by Dominion Voting Systems against Murdoch's Fox News network was about to go to trial. At the 11th hour, Fox settled the case for $787.5 million. Dominion's suit hinged upon the accusation that various presenters and contributors on the network, widely regarded as a key architect of Donald Trump's political success and packed with sycophantic supporters of the sex abuser president, had knowingly aired fallacious election fraud theories about Dominion's voting machines in the 2020 election. In other words, Dominion would have to prove that Fox News hosts, employees and confidants of Rupert Murdoch had deliberately and repeatedly lied to their viewers. As with Leveson in the UK, it led to the disclosure of reams of internal text messages and emails sent and received by correspondents unaware that their communications would ever be made public. And as with Leveson, the content highlighted blatant contempt for the notion of speaking truth to power. Those correspondents included key figures in the company, including star presenter Tucker Carlson and Rupert Murdoch himself. In his deposition to the court, Murdoch told a Dominion lawyer that he had the power to keep election deniers off Fox News, but chose not to. Asked why he continued to allow Mike Lindell, the CEO of a pillow company, major advertiser, and one of the most prominent disseminators of election fraud lies, to make outlandish claims on Fox News, Murdoch explained that it was a financial, not a political decision, and agreed that it is not red or blue, it is green. This last is a reference to political allegiances. Republicans are red and Democrats blue, being completely subjugated to the colour, literally, of money. What these documents and depositions revealed about people on the Murdoch payroll was, in many ways, even more damning. They provide an insight into the workings of a media empire diabolically dedicated to only advancing the interests of the emperor. When viewed in conjunction with what we know about how completely that empire has infiltrated the British political establishment, the scale of the damage done to democracy by one man's megalomania comes into focus. In the UK, America, and his native Australia, everything from the weaponization of climate change denial to the promotion of vampiric free market economics has long left observers wondering whether Murdoch and his acolytes actually believe what they peddle or whether facts are entirely irrelevant to their output. With Leveson, the way in which Murdoch's people obtained information was disgusting and illegal, but the resulting stories were, in the strictest sense, factually true. The details stolen from people's voicemails were actually real. Dominion, by contrast, demonstrated a deliberate detachment from reality by some of the most powerful and well-rewarded voices in the English-speaking world. The scale of the moral corruption involved is almost incomprehensible, but as shown by Leveson, such is his power and influence that its disclosure seems unlikely to affect Murdoch's claw-like grip on the windpipe of our democracies. This is no grand conspiracy. At its simplest, if you work for him or aspire to do so, then you simply cannot call out the corruption that hides in plain sight. There are brilliant journalists working for Murdoch, undoubtedly some of the finest in the world, and there are grubby opportunists like Piers Morgan and, until the Dominion settlement, Tucker Carlson. The tragedy is that the former are compelled to stay as silent as the latter, and consequently, the utterly abnormal appears completely normal. The Dominion disclosures, as with Leveson's, will not detain us unduly here. They certainly did not create the ecosystem in which the moral corruption of Boris Johnson or the serial incompetence of Liz Truss could be ushered into power. Rather, they illustrate the nature of the beast that all aspiring British prime ministers of the last 50 years, including Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, have felt obliged to woo and indulge. In many ways, the cooperation and even the collusion are not as concerning as the nature of what is being wooed. And while there is plenty of evidence in Britain, as we shall shortly see, it is worth taking a quick look at one way in which the Dominion case laid bare the utter disregard for truth deployed by key Murdoch personnel in the US. Astonishingly, the biggest star on the network that amplified Trump's lies and groomed his supporters with endless xenophobia and immigration scaremongering was someone who actually couldn't stand the man and fully appreciated the awfulness of his presidency. Still, it was good for business. On the 18th of February 2017, Donald Trump delivered a speech in which he cited Sweden's purported problems with immigrant-related violence as a justification for his continuing demonization of immigrants. "You look at what's happening last night in Sweden," he said. "Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible." There was just one problem with this race baiting. There had been no incident in Sweden the previous night. The local, an English-language Swedish news website, went as far as to state, "Nothing spectacular happened in Sweden on Friday." Reuters reported that Swedes were using the Twitter hashtag Last Night in Sweden to post pictures of reindeer, Swedish meatballs, and people assembling the country's famous IKEA furniture. The former Swedish Prime Minister, Carl Bildt, wrote on Twitter, "Sweden? Terror attack? What has he been smoking? Questions abound." Trump tried to answer those questions the following day when he tweeted, "My statement as to what's happening in Sweden was in reference to a story that was broadcast on Fox News regarding immigrants and Sweden." Tucker Carlson, whose show Trump had been watching, gave an interview to his own network in which he acknowledged the non-existence of any actual incident, but insisted nonetheless that Trump was right to draw attention to problems being caused by immigrants in Sweden, even though Reuters had reported that official statistics showed the crime rate had fallen since 2005, as the country took in hundreds of thousands of refugees from war-torn countries such as Syria and Iraq. Disingenuous doesn't cover it. And this is just one example of the sinister fact-free symbiosis that developed between Trump, Fox News, and Carlson in particular. All the more remarkable then to discover what Carlson really thought about the man he had arguably done more than anyone to catapult into the White House. "What he's good at is destroying things," Carlson texted his producer, Alex Pfeiffer, on the 5th of November 2020. "He's the undisputed world champion of that. He could easily destroy us if we play it wrong." On the 4th of January 2021, 2 days before Trump's call to action saw a mob of his supporters attack the US Capitol, Carlson texted Pfeiffer, "I hate him passionately," adding on the subject of Trump's presidency, "We're all pretending we've got a lot to show for it because admitting what a disaster it's been is too tough to digest. But come on, there really isn't an upside to Trump." When Fox unexpectedly dispensed with Carlson's services shortly after the Dominion settlement, a Daily Telegraph columnist in the UK, Tim Stanley, opined that it was not the suspicion of racism, the blatant lies, or the revelations about the contempt in which he held his own audience that prompted British liberals to hate Tucker Carlson. It was instead his polish. As Stanley unintentionally illustrates, the idea that people may be genuinely disgusted by disgusting conduct is something that the right-wing British media has become increasingly keen to rubbish in recent years. The veteran American newscaster Dan Rather captured the fraudulent essence of this early in Ronald Reagan's presidency when he described attempts to convince the public that problems are not problems, but that the people who call attention to them are problems. A journalist at Andrew Neil's Spectator magazine, James Bartholomew, claims to have coined the phrase virtue signalling in 2015. It quickly became a pithy way for columnists and commentators to denigrate any acts of altruism, particularly when they are undertaken by members of the liberal elite. The wider process of demeaning decency serves a much darker purpose too, calling into question the authenticity and integrity of people at least trying to do the right thing, conflates them with people who are clearly and categorically doing wrong. It is why the increasingly popular phrase to describe politicians, "they're all as bad as each other," is so uniquely depressing. It is a large part of the reason why false equivalence, where a guest with extensive knowledge and experience is pitted against an equal and opposite guest with none, has wheedled its way into corners of national discourse that were once respectful of expertise and evidence. And it is why Murdoch and Daily Mail journalism routinely spawns social media barbecues of any vaguely prominent critic of that criminal media nexus who demonstrates fallibility. The fact that many modern readers will see this symbiosis between political and media power as unremarkable is a mark of how pervasive it is and how successful it has been. It is all a very far cry from 1840, when, in a lecture entitled On Heroes and Hero Worship, the philosopher Thomas Carlyle cited a godfather of modern conservatism, Edmund Burke. Burke said there were three estates in Parliament, but in the reporters' gallery yonder, there sat a fourth estate more important far than they all. The importance of a fourth estate, of journalism that scrutinises and challenges the other three, in this context, the nobility in the House of Lords, the bishops in the House of Lords, and the House of Commons, is obvious. That it no longer describes much of the British and American media is a consequence in large part of Rupert Murdoch's rejection of these traditional expectations in the early 1980s. He explained himself to a biographer, Thomas Kiernan, in the 1986 book Citizen Murdoch, stating, "The press is sitting around here doing its usual thing, sneering at Reagan and waiting to pounce on him the moment he stumbles. The whole Reagan package needs much more support by the press." It signals the abandonment of any pretense at journalistic objectivity and the active demonization of dissenting, even arguably accurate, voices in the news media. It is here that the echoes of what would happen in Britain 30 years later are loudest. On the 28th of June 1984, Murdoch joined Ben Bradlee, the legendary executive editor of the Washington Post when Woodward and Bernstein broke the Watergate scandal, on a panel convened by the American Enterprise Institute to ask, "Is there a political elite in America?" In his excellent and exhaustively researched 2012 book, Murdoch's Politics, David McKnight describes their contributions as a dialogue of the deaf, but whether Bradlee heard them or not, Murdoch said at least two fascinating things. One predictable, one almost poignantly anything but. First, presaging the dismal media-fueled populism that would usher in Brexit, Trump and Boris Johnson, he accused the press of ignoring the traditional values of the great masses of this country and of attempting to change the political agenda. Second, and almost unbelievably from the perspective of 2023, he said, the press should be anti-establishment, should keep its distance from authority, from big business, and all vested interests. It's only natural that it should be questioning and sceptical. That leads to being understood very often as having a liberal position when it really represents nothing more than a skill. I am yet to come across a finer argument in defence of the often vague accusations of a liberal bias in the media. It is poignant because it reminds us that Murdoch was once, in his heart of hearts, a journalist. Born into the business, there is no way he could have achieved such international domination without a deep understanding of and affection for the trade. Consider, though, the gulf between a professed determination to keep distance from authority and the evident coziness on display between David Cameron, Andy Coulson, and Rebecca Brooks in 2009. It is as if two competing and contradictory components of his character, both on full display here, are vying for supremacy, the journalist and the plutocrat. I am not sure the battle ever ended. It is this dichotomy, coupled with his epic ambition, that explains the unique nature of his increasingly blurred news and opinion empire. It is one of the reasons why he continues to inspire great personal loyalty, even among former employees who may balk at the activities of some of their erstwhile colleagues. I think it also explains how he can simultaneously publish some of the sewage we shall examine shortly and genuinely superb journalism, such as the work of Gabriel Pogrand and Harry York at the Sunday Times referred to in the introduction. Did he found Fox News, for example, because he truly believed that the media was dominated by a left-wing elite, a notion that McKnight points out had been a distinctive theme of the right under Nixon? Or was it simply because he saw an opportunity to secure a ton of money and influence? Or both? David Yelland, the founder of communications company KTP, was editor of The Sun from 1998 to 2003 and deputy editor of Murdoch's New York Post from 1996 to 1998. His perspective on his former boss, his empire, and this dissonance between journalist and plutocrat is uniquely insightful and has not been publicly shared before. I first got to know Rupert Murdoch in New York in the years before I became editor of The Sun in 1998, he told me. I was then business editor and later deputy editor of his New York Post, at that time the only US daily that he operated in a liberal city and in a liberal era, with Bill Clinton as president and the then quite benign Rudolph Giuliani as mayor. The Rupert I knew was not the Rupert I see written about. He was great company, utterly inspiring, and he suddenly took a huge interest in me. He would stop and talk with me for long periods. He was interested in my story and why I had worn a wig through all my teenage years. David had childhood alopecia. Right up to age 31 when I went topless. He said, that took guts. He seemed to understand me, and I was, of course, very excited to have his confidence. He was super smart. He listened. He had liberal social values. He gave the staff time. He was in the early stages of his courtship with Wendy Deng, and he was very happy. Most of all, he was incredibly interested in Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and how they might change the UK following the 1997 election. He was a wonderful boss and very kind to me when my wife Tanya was diagnosed with breast cancer during her pregnancy with our son Max. Basically, he picked me and backed me. He was a wonderful boss, and this is something I must always remember and credit him for. Fox News was set up when I was working in the building. 1211 Avenues of Americas, New York City. Roger Ailes used to come up for drinks at the end of the day. We knew him very well. We all thought he was quite mad and would never succeed. How wrong we were. It was Roger who changed Rupert. Fox News became and remains the most profitable news channel in the world, and Roger became an untouchable for a long while. He was the person that showed millions could be made from right-wing media. Up until then, the major US broadcasters and print press were largely liberal. This turning point made the liberal editors in London, under their boss Les Hinton, look very pink. I think Rupert is a very different person than many realise. He is not a hirer and firer. He is actually incredibly loyal to his people. Even if senior editors are moved aside, they are often offered other roles should they choose to stay. People ask me even now, why did KRM, Keith Rupert Murdoch, stay so loyal to Rebecca Brooks? The answer is that this is how he is. He values and applauds people who take shit for him, and she took a great deal of that, whatever you may think of her. He also values courage and the ability to be able to put up with intense pressure. So it is actually his loyalty to his people that cost him in some cases. Some on the News Corporation or Fox boards would have fired Roger and Rebecca years earlier, but he simply would not budge. This esprit de corps, or buccaneering spirit, is imbued in the News Corp culture. It really is us against the world, and this allows the company to take immense risks and move very quickly. It means there are very rarely leaks from within, but I think it is this culture, with its lack of countervailing power, such as independent non-executive directors or a chairman, a lack of really robust advisors, a lack of outside counsel, that resulted in the company drifting toward the far right, first under Roger and then during Trump's era. Too few internal people spoke out, and there are good people there. Note how James Murdoch spoke out as he left, a very significant moment. I look at the company now and see how it conspired to allow untruths to be told to the British people around Brexit, and how it helped create the great national disaster and did the same with Trump and around some aspects of COVID, and even worse on climate change. At some point, the company began to side with the dark side and not the angels, and this is a great tragedy for readers and consumers of the news channels and newspapers. How did it happen? Slowly at first, and then quickly. It became apparent that the digital revolution could be fought off if you were prepared to exploit that new world by allowing extreme journalism. This is because only extremes thrive in the digital world, or at least that has been the case so far. We can now see the three ways Murdoch contributed to creating an ecosystem in which a country like the United Kingdom could be broken on the wheel of corruption and incompetence. First, and most unprecedented, the complete erasure of the line between media and government, the revolving door of personnel moving merrily from newspaper cheerleader for a government to prominent roles in those governments, and then back again. If the most powerful media interests in the land see themselves as actively working in cooperation with a government towards shared ends, then, even if other parts of the empire occasionally do some proper journalism, the public interest is strangled. On the 25th of February 2016, for example, the city editor of the London Evening Standard, Anthony Hilton, wrote, "I once asked Rupert Murdoch why he was so opposed to the European Union. That's easy," he replied. "When I go into Downing Street, they do what I say. When I go to Brussels, they take no notice." Hilton stood by his story when, desperate for government approval of a deal allowing his 21st Century Fox network to buy the 61% of Sky he did not already own, Murdoch took the unusual step of writing to The Guardian in December of the same year to deny that the exchange had ever taken place. Who knows who to believe? Second, the deliberate denigration of dissenting voices, whether as members of that largely mythical liberal elite or as agents of political correctness and latterly wokeness. When combined with what Dan Rather identified as the determination to cast the people pointing out the problems as the real problems, it heralds an open season on anyone deemed to be difficult. This last is the trickiest to realise. And it has been achieved by allowing a relatively small number of editors, columnists, and commentators to disseminate such vicious and undiluted hatred into public discourse that we are no longer shocked by it. On the 16th of December 2022, Sun columnist Jeremy Clarkson wrote of loathing Meghan Markle on a cellular level and grinding my teeth and dreaming of the day when she is made to parade naked through the streets of every town in Britain while the crowds chant shame and throw lumps of excrement at her. On the 15th of February 2020, the TV presenter Caroline Flack took her own life days before she was due to face trial for assaulting her boyfriend. The Sun had somehow obtained pictures of her bloodied bedroom, a potential crime scene, more potential Leveson 2 territory, following the alleged assault. Her friend and fellow broadcaster Laura Whitmore had little doubt about where at least some of the responsibility for Caroline's anguish lay, using her weekly BBC Radio 5 live show to state, "To the press, the newspapers who create clickbait, who demonise and tear down success, we've had enough. I've seen journalists and Twitter warriors talk of this tragedy, and they themselves twisted what the truth is. Your words affect people. To paparazzi and tabloids looking for a cheap sell, to trolls hiding behind a keyboard, enough." 4 days after Clarkson's Meghan Markle piece appeared, Caroline's mother Christine called Sheila Fogarty's show on LBC to express her shock that it had been published at all. She went on to compare this article to press coverage received by her daughter, whose death had prompted widespread but ultimately fruitless calls for an end to the misogynistic language routinely directed at women and girls by prominent media figures. "My daughter was Caroline Flack, and what was printed in the papers, so much of it was untrue," a clearly emotional Christine said. "Why write something so bad? We thought when Carrie died, this thing about being kind, it isn't a joke, it is a real thing. I can see even though Meghan and Harry have got all that money, even they said if they can't win, how can anyone else win? Someone like Jeremy Clarkson can just say what he wants, but it gets printed. That's the worst thing." The previous March, Piers Morgan had been forced to resign from a lucrative slot on breakfast television after refusing to apologise for publicly pouring scorn on Meghan's account of her own suicidal ideation.